Welcome to Disruptive Adventism. My name is Jose Briones, and I'll be your host for this podcast. This podcast is about discussing the polemical statements and practices that are part of the Adventist fabric, which in turn shape this belief system to be unique and relevant for today's society. Thank you for listening today. Today marks the end of our Law and Order series. We hope that you enjoy this episode with Michael Nixon. And with nothing else to say, let us just begin. It's time for our last episode on the series on Law and Order, and today we'll be discussing the topic of civility. What does it mean to be civil? What does it encompass? And how can we keep a civil attitude, and when not to be civil as well? So we have invited Michael Nixon to be with us and to talk about this important topic. How's it going, Mike?
Good, man. Thanks for having me on, Jose. I know it took us a little bit to get this scheduled, but I'm really excited to be on the pod, so thanks for inviting me.
No, thanks for being willing, and I really appreciate your time here.
Sure.
So before we get started, as always, we'd like to get to know our guests a little bit more.
Sure.
So tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Sure, definitely. So currently, I'm serving as the VP for Diversity and Inclusion here at Andrews University. This is my second year in that role. It was a newly created position, so I guess maybe I feel like I know a little bit more about what I'm doing than I did last year. The first year, you're just kind of getting your feet wet, understanding, you know, what the lay of the land is, what's been happening here on campus before you got here. So I spent a lot of time actually just having conversations like this, listening to people, dialoguing with them, wanting to hear more about what they felt was needed here at Andrews. Actually, this morning, I was having breakfast with a board member, and we were talking about some of the things that have been going on our journey here at Andrews. And so I feel like that learning process is a constant process for me. And so much more than wanting to be an expert in the field, I kind of pushed back on the whole concept of being a diversity and inclusion expert, because I think that this work is just so difficult. But I think it's very rewarding in the sense that what we're doing here, I think, is at the center of who God is. I think that God has gone to great lengths to include us all in the opportunity of salvation, for example. Mm. You know, he spared nothing to save us or to give us the opportunity to be saved. And so with that motivating example in mind, that's sort of what I bring to this work here. So yeah, I've been doing that. I'm an attorney by trade. So before I worked here, I was a civil rights attorney in New York City at the Fair Housing Justice Center, working on fair housing discrimination cases. Did that for about 4 years before getting here. So yeah, happy to be with you.
So you have worked in the area with government, you know, and that kind of civil engagement per se. And you are also working with the school now, like, you know, in Adventist context and when it comes to being civil. So let's kind of get started and talk about some of the definitions. So to you, what is to be a civil individual?
Sure. Well, it's a really good question. And I actually, as I mentioned to you offset, we've been working on campus on a sort of summation document or summary document on free speech and civil discourse on our campus. It's a process that started during last school year, earlier this calendar year in, like, let's say January or so. One of our professors on campus, Dwayne McBride, was chairing that process, and I was the recording secretary through it. And so we basically sat down and tried to hammer out some definitions for civility in particular. And so we reached out to a definition that's included on the Institute for Civility's website. They're an institute that helps organizations and campuses really try to pursue a better foundation for discourse and being civil, things of that nature. And so their definition of civility is actually this: civility is claiming and caring for one's identity, needs, and beliefs without degrading someone else and what someone else is in the process. And I really like that. So that what it's saying is, like, in the first instance, civility actually is caring for your identity, for the things that you believe in, for the things that you need. That's what civility is rooted in. So it's not sort of this passive sort of thing that sometimes is played out in our discourse nowadays. But being the act of being civil is actually beginning with making sure that who you are as a person, the things that you believe, the things that you need, the things that you see as right and just and fair, are valued by other people. But in the process of doing that, we are called to not degrade someone else's identity, value system, needs, belief system in that process. Mm. So that's what I think at the core civility truly is. It isn't, basically sanitizing one's beliefs just in order to be acceptable in a broader context, but it is making your point or getting who you are across in a passionate way, in a clear way, but also in a way that does not degrade somebody else. Mm. And I think that's really the line with civility when you're sort of towing into just the ad hominem attacks or just making things very personal and really wanting to demean or shame someone. So I think with civility, one of the really important distinctions are between rebuke, which I think is very biblical, and shame, which I would say is not. I think with a rebuke, we have an example of that, like, for example, in Acts with Peter and Paul. I forget exactly where it's found right now, but when Peter is sitting with the Gentiles over a meal, and then when his Jewish friends come into the room, he immediately switched tables to sit with the Jews. Paul didn't, pull Peter aside and privately talk to him about that and say, hey, man, why did you do that? Because of the fact that what Peter did was public, he publicly rebuked him in the presence of everyone and basically said, you yourself essentially live as the Gentiles live, but then when your Jewish brethren come in, you act as if they're unclean when they're just as clean as you are, that kind of a thing. And of course, did it in love, but did it publicly. And so when you read that, it's a bit of an uncomfortable story to read because it looks initially like, man, Paul's really sort of putting Peter on blast here, Why didn't he just pull him aside? Why didn't he write him a letter? Nowadays, why didn't he send him an email? What I'm saying? Why didn't he do it private? Did Paul know Matthew 18? Why didn't he, come to him in that private setting? But Paul, motivated by the Spirit, thought that it was important for Peter to understand the error of his ways in the presence of those he had wronged, as well as, the others that he was trying to, rub shoulders with in a more preferential way because of his bias, Now, shaming in that context would have been, Paul saying to Peter, what kind of Christian are you? You're not a disciple of Christ. Didn't you walk with Christ? How could you be such a bigot, or this and that? Because Paul understood his own infirmities, his own, sins, his own shortcomings. I think he was able to deal with Peter in an empathetic way, as opposed to just shaming him and making him look crazy or making him look bad. So a contemporary example would be, dragging him on Twitter or whatever the case may be, just for the, the purpose of making him feel bad. So that's, and I know I'm giving a long definition for sure, but that's sort of the way I see civility. Civility can be uncomfortable at times, but it's always rooted in relationship, in empathy, in love, but also in being just, in being equitable, in being fair. So that's civility to me.
As I listen, something that you pointed out is mainly how this relates into discourse, and the relationship that you have with another individual that can go into rebuke or shame. Mm-hmm. And to add to your point is also to the point that Paul definitely rebuked Peter for the sake of other people.
Right.
Because it was there, he was shaming. Peter is shaming them.
Right.
So Paul is rebuking Peter. So he stops shaming and still valuing the other person, right, and saying, hey, no, we're going to eat with you. Right. We're still going to be there.
Right.
But there's more to civility than that. Mm-hmm. And in the sense of engaging in the public arena.
Sure.
These examples, as you said, some of them may require an email or a letter. Uh-huh. Some of them require a public discourse. How can we be more civil in the public arena, given the polarization that we're experiencing? Sure. A lot of people are talking about it, but how can we still be like Paul and do the rebuking or the necessary dialogue instead of the shaming?
Sure. I think that's a really good question. I think, again, it's rooted in what are the core values? What are the beliefs that are motivating whatever it is you're saying? You know, so for me, you know, I like to, and it's not always the case that you can't always be prepared for a dialogue, but whenever I'm talking about maybe a difficult or topic that people could see as potentially tense or something like that, I try to think through my thoughts beforehand. I try to anticipate the questions so that in the best way possible, I'm able to analyze my words and say, okay, what parts of my belief system and my core values are being furthered by these words? You know, and if I can't make that connection, then I could potentially be saying it just for the purpose of shaming the other person or making the other person look bad. So in the public arena, I think it's really important for us to be clear on what the actual value or belief system is that we're furthering in what we're saying. So that it's not about, you know, your tribal connection to a political party. You know, let's just look at, I mean, there, you know, social justice is like an umbrella term that's used a lot. And there's a lot of different issues under that umbrella. So let's say, for example, when we're talking about like issues of racial justice, if we're able to connect, you know, our desire for more equity, you know, across racial lines and less discrimination and things of that nature, just really sticking to the reasons why you believe that and the reasons why that should be valued and continuing to hammer at that, as opposed to saying, oh, well, because you don't have the same value system as me, or because you don't see it the same as me, then you're, you know, insert your favorite label here, you know? And so I think the less we can get into making value judgments about people, and, you know, keep our value judgments to the issues and the ideas that we're dialoguing about, then I think when we're in the public arena, we can, you know, we know then, at least for us personally, that we're not making it something personal about shaming someone. So if you have disagreements, like, for example, with our current president, talk about the issues you disagree with him on, as opposed to just talking about, you know, how crazy his tweets are, even though that might be the case in your opinion. It may be frustrating. I think when we're speaking publicly, we have to be mindful of how some of those different things may be received. And then everything that you've said that's good can be discounted just because somebody heard that one part where it seemed like you were shaming someone. Mm. And then everything that you said gets lost because of that one thing. You know, because I think sometimes in discourse nowadays, people are expecting the shaming to happen. So they're almost like waiting for that. And so while you're saying all these other good things, it's like, yeah, okay, okay, okay. But like, what side are you on? You know, or like, what's your tribal connection, though? Like, are you a liberal? Are you conservative? Because once I learned that, then, okay, I know everything I need to know about you. So I try very hard to push against that, because I think we need to be a bit more nuanced in how we discuss issues. Like, it can't just always be a zero-sum game where if I know a couple characteristics about who you are on the fringes, then I automatically assume I know everything about your opinion. And so I think what we need in the public arena is much more honest conversation and understanding that, you know, none of us have the absolute right answers to any of these questions, and they're tough questions. And there can be difficult conversations, but we can get to some good answers if we're civil with one another.
So to a certain degree, what I hear you say is that shaming other people is not being civil.
Right.
So shaming mm-hmm. other people enters into the arena of you disrespecting them and disrespecting their authority.
Right.
As much as you may disagree with the leaders of your senator or maybe mm-hmm. the president, it doesn't give us the right to shame them or to say, oh, look at his funny head, or look mm-hmm. at his mm-hmm. toupee or whatever, right. you know, or different right. things. Or, right. hey, look, he's black, or she's white, or mm-hmm. he's Hispanic. He definitely wants all the immigrants to come or whatever,
right.
you know.
Right.
Now, in the space of political arena, are you discounting the engagement of political, for example, mm-hmm. political engagement among the churches, or would you discourage partisanship in this case? What's the difference in between?
No, I think we definitely need to be politically engaged.
Okay.
I mean, And the first thing I'll say real quick before I get to that is that I think another important part of civility is respect. And so one of the things we also did was we created a foundational definition for respect. And that definition basically is civil discourse is characterized by respect for all and avoiding any intentional discomfort to others in our speech and expression. Now, that this part was a bit tricky because I think that in civil discourse, there will be discomfort. But the question is, are we intentionally making people uncomfortable?
Can that be? Yes.
And I think that's the distinction there, you know, because I think sometimes, and this goes to sort of the shaming piece as well, sometimes people will say things just for shock value. And, you know, we have politicians that do that. You know, they'll say things and they just know for a fact that it's going to trigger people on the quote unquote other side. You know what I mean? And I think that's where we sort of veer off into some really dangerous territory. But as it pertains to political engagement, I think the first thing that I'll say is our church is already politically engaged. I mean, every church has a religious liberty department. We have lobbyists, you know, from our church that go on Capitol Hill throughout the year to advocate for protecting our religious freedoms. That's secured through the political process. You know, we as a church can't unilaterally decide for the country that, you know, we have freedom of religion. So the very act of us going to church is in a way being politically engaged. You know, we're exercising our right to express our religion freely in that space. So political engagement is very important. And I think that we, and you made an important distinction, I think that we do have to be careful with partisanship. You know, even if our, again, I think it goes back to understanding where we stand on the issues, you know, being informed. That's why being engaged is so informed. You know, what are some of the biblical principles that can allow me to form a well thought out opinion on these different issues, and then seeing where different political candidates align with myself on those issues. So it's not as easy then as just saying, you know, I'm going to accept, you know, the conservative platform or the liberal platform in its entirety, because there are nuances even in the politicians that would label themselves as a part of those parties, you know? So, but I think political engagement is very important. And then also, just particularly as a person of color in this country, many of the freedoms that I enjoy were secured through the political process, you know, things like the Voting Rights Act. There was a time not too many decades ago in this country where someone like me could not vote in this country, you know, because of the color of my skin. The church didn't secure that right for me. Our political system did, you know. And so that's one example of it. You know, I mentioned I worked in the housing arena previously. The Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968. Before that time, you know, there was no legal recourse in response to housing discrimination in the housing market, which is really the foundation upon which folks are able to build wealth in this country. So we talk about pursuing the American dream. How can our church members do that without having fair and equal access to housing? So these are issues of our members' everyday lives that affect them all throughout the week. And when they walk into our church, you know, doors, you know, we can't tell them to sort of turn off their brains to the things that have impacted them. They want to know, what does the church have to say about this? What does God have to say to me in the midst of my pain as a result of some of the things that I'm experiencing in this country? You know, and so I think it's very important for church leaders and for our church to be very clear on where we stand on different issues, and to make sure that our members know and understand that they have folks that can, from a biblical moral context, give them a perspective upon which to make sense of the world around them. Because in the absence of that, then they'll have to go to other movements that are speaking to those issues. And I think that God has something to say about a lot of the different things we're experiencing in this country, in our world. We just have to be willing vessels to deliver that information to our congregations all across the country. So political engagement is really important, in my opinion.
Yes. As you're mentioning this political engagement and respect mm-hmm. as the foundation underneath, I think of Romans 13.
Mm-hmm.
But that passage is very tricky because it has been morphed into kind of saying, well, you're not going to disagree with the authorities. You're going to just, you know, agree with whatever they say and respect them. I think that the idea of respect here is very important.
Yeah.
And as you point out, intentional discomfort, how is that done in a civil manner or uncivil to this case? Because there's a there's an element of how language really transforms the way that we see things.
Right.
If you say, for example, if you say the word white or black, or if you even say for Hispanics, for example, beaner, right? It's a very demeaning word, and you automatically have a lot of emotions attached to that word. And there are many words out there that, crooked.
Yeah.
Like, you know, for example, for Democrats, if you say crooked, for white Americans, if you say cracker or, you know, things like that, those
slurs.
Are very, very slurs, you know, very powerful language.
Mm-hmm.
So this intentional discomfort, and by the way, I want to say, I apologize if you take offense to any of the slurs that I said. Mm-hmm. I was just illustrating for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
If you're listening, please forgive me per se. But language is very powerful.
Yeah.
Language carries a lot of meaning. Language carries a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm.
How can we make sure to be precise and at the same time do not provide these blanket terms or vague ideas and focus more on the goals of being civil, being respectful, and pushing the dialogue?
Yeah. I think you made an important point. I think language is really important. So one of the first things I try to tell folks in every conversation, I think that as much as possible, if we're able to prepare people in advance for whatever conversation we're intending to have, that makes the conversation better. So what I mean by that very simply is when people kind of know what to expect, you kind of give them the opportunity to opt in or opt out. And if they're opting in, they kind of know what they're coming to talk about.
Mm.
So that's sort of the first thing, trying to prepare your audience as much as possible. The second thing I think throughout is providing thoughtful disclaimers. You just provided one. You know, you mentioned some examples of slurs and you immediately, you know, said, explained why you did it. And you know, provide an apology for those who maybe have been offended by some of those things. So providing some of those things, even at the front end, if possible, saying, you know, look, we're having a conversation about, you know, racial discrimination in the church. I'm going to, you know, in that effort to describe different phenomena or things that have happened in our country or things of that nature, use various different group identifying terms that may trigger some feelings or thoughts for you, but letting you know in advance, this is, you know, this is the purpose of our conversation. So I may say something like white privilege or white supremacy, but when I say those things, and then this is the third thing I would say, when you say some of those terms, being very clear about what you mean by them. So giving a definition for what you mean by, let's say, privilege or white supremacy, or so you're saying that, you know, for example, with the term like white supremacy, I'm not saying that every white person is a white supremacist or whatever the case may be. But what I may mean is that there are some systemic institutional issues that have worked towards the benefit of that particular people group, you know, over history. And these are the reasons why, you know, I can point to that kind of a thing. So I think that, you know, being able to, as you're using different terms, define them so people know what you're talking about and know what you mean by them. And so they're not making assumptions about what you believe. Because I think in the absence of being clear, people are going to fill in their meanings for you. And I think that is a really key, those are really key ways to make sure that the dialogue remains respectful and that there is clarity, but that you are also able to be clear about the topic that you are presenting and talking about it in very clear terms and hopefully having a good edifying conversation about it.
One last area that I would like to touch on as you're mentioning that is the idea of uncivility or civil disobedience. where you may respect the politician, as in the authority that they represent, but you disagree with their policies, mm-hmm. or you disagree with another person, not necessarily in the political arena, but in the church arena as well. And while you may disagree with them, you want to be disobedient, mm-hmm. but being civil at the same time. Sure. And in the church right now, for example, we have a larger conversation of the compliance committees and, mm-hmm. you know, how to, is there such a thing as being able to disagree with authority to a certain degree, go in a different way that mm-hmm. they're trying to do in order for a common goal or a betterment of a people group, for example?
Sure, sure.
And how is that done?
No, I think that's a phenomenal question. And I think the key is actually in the way that you presented it. So I think there's a difference between, like, if even maybe it's incivility, but, you know, a lack of civility, uncivility, as you put it. I think there's a difference between that and civil disobedience. Mm. So, like, a lack of civility or uncivility would be, to me, again, going into the shaming. So let's say in the church context, it would just be, I don't know, ad hominem attacks against like the GC president, Ted Wilson, or other church leadership, or the broad label of conservatives in our church, whatever the case may be, or liberals, whatever the case may be, NAD President Dan Jackson. Wherever you land on, you know, your opinion on some of these issues, it's just making it very a personal attack, which would be a lack of civility. I think civil disobedience, again, would go to a very principled discussion about where you differ. Our president, Dr. Luxton, one of the things that she said in making her comments from the floor before the GC made their vote was that trust will develop unity in ways that compliance and policy cannot. Mm. And basically what she was saying, she made a very reasoned civil disagreement with GC leadership, with the folks who are in favor of the document, and basically saying that, and she was very gracious in the way she worded things too, because she talks about this perceived, because there's a perception of the GC overreaching in their power, mm-hmm. right? So she didn't make an accusation that the GC was overreaching. But she was basically saying that there are good reasons that people perceive that the GC is overreaching. And I just think that we can pursue, you know, the goals of biblical unity in a much better way. Mm-hmm. She was probably maybe a bit more civil than maybe someone like me would have been, you know, because you can get very frustrated at times with some of these discussions. But that's why I value her leadership so much, is because she is able to express, you know, with clarity her disagreement on an issue, but doing so in a civil way, in an empathetic way, in love. And I think that's what's really needed by our church leaders right now, is to not, you know, just capitulate to something that they feel is unjust, that's not right, or is an overreach, or is, you know, potentially punishing areas of the church for disagreements over non-biblical issues. I think that's taking things way too far, and it's really dangerous. But in the midst of that, I think we're called to continue to express that disagreement in a civil way. And I think the comments that she made from the floor are a really good example of how we can do that. And hopefully over time, more and more people are able to understand that if we can develop more of a trust, because that's really the issue, the whole issue in our church right now, this is probably the last thing I'll say about this in particular, is that I think what Dr. Luxton perceived and what a lot of us are perceiving is that there is a lack of trust really across the body of the world church. I'll give you a quick outside example that I shared with her. It's maybe about a month ago, Joe Biden was a guest speaker at LMC, mm-hmm. a former vice president. And he talked a lot about his relationship with John McCain, the senator who recently passed, senator of Arizona. And they were like best friends. But of course, you know, extreme opposites on a lot of issues. but had this amazing friendship that they developed over time, and they worked together on a lot of different issues. And he talks about how, and of course he spent, you know, Joe Biden, and I didn't know this about him, but he was the youngest person ever elected to the Senate. He was like 30 years old when he got elected. So he spent decades in the Senate before becoming vice president. One of the things that they did, you know, in the Senate room is they had this like little cafeteria for the 100 senators, and they set up tables. So there was a table for the Democrats, table for the Republicans, but there was also a table that was big enough to seat everyone when they wanted to come together and have conversations, you know. And so one of the big things him and John would push a lot, Senator McCain, would be for more and more folks to come together at that middle table and have dialogue and have discourse about difficult issues. And so what he said was that over time, you know, after President Obama was elected and he became vice president and the discourse just got just so volatile, he said probably, and you know, of course, as vice president, you're president of the Senate, so you're still involved with the Senate a lot. He said maybe about 2 years into President Obama's term, you'd go into that lunchroom and it was just mostly the two tables. You know, there wasn't a lot of people at the middle table anymore. And then he said after President Trump's election, if you go into that room now, there are no tables.
Wow.
There's no one. People don't even go in there to eat anymore. People eat in separate rooms, separate silos. He was saying that even now, since he's been, you know, out of politics, he'll meet a lot with Republican leaders and they'll basically make him vow to secrecy to tell nobody that they met. Because if their base knew that they were meeting with a Democrat, then they would be finished, you know, just because why are you talking to the other side, you know? And so he spent a lot of time when he talked about just this fracturing of our discourse in this country. And, you know, as I was talking with Dr. Luxton, she was just saying, like, she just doesn't understand why some of these division presidents won't sit down and just talk with one another. You know, there are division presidents that she knows because she just kind of floats around the room and she'll talk to different people. She's told me, you know, they're division presidents from areas of the world that don't differ very much from Dan Jackson and the NAD. But if they were even to be seen talking with him, their constituents would be like, oh, what's going on? You know, is he going to go? Are they going to get liberal out here, too, or whatever the case may be, you know? So I think, sadly, the sort of fracturing we've seen in our political system is being reflected in the way we discourse or have dialogue in the church. And there are not enough people sitting at the table like you and I are right now, just having dialogue, sharing each other's stories, talking about what's happening in their area of the world church, the sort of mission that's happening, the sort of soul, you know, the souls that are being saved, things of that nature. And I think if we truly were focused on mission, because they keep talking about how we need this compliance process so we can focus on mission, makes no sense to me at all. I think if we truly were focused on mission, we would understand, or the GC would understand, that it's important for them to trust the leadership of various areas of the world church to know that they can decide what's best for them in their area of the world on non-biblical, non-fundamental belief, non-scriptural, non-moral issues, you know, as it pertains to how can we best effectuate the gospel mission in our division of the world. And does that, and of course, the, you know, the elephant in the room is it's all about women in ministry, women's ordination. Does that mission include women? And I believe in a lot of areas of the world, it does and it can. And so I think the GC needs to trust that the leadership in those areas can best decide how they can function as their part of the body in that area of the world. Mm-hmm. Biblical unity as opposed to uniformity, which I think the compliance document is seeking.
Mm-hmm. Well, good summation right there of church and political arena and, and, you know, understanding how these things have been fractured. As I listened to you, the only thing that came to my mind was the first definition that you gave of civility and how, like, it's very impressive or very interesting that even within our church, we are kind of not looking at the humanity of the other person. Because at the end of the day, like, yeah, I have an identity. I may have an opinion, but I can come and disagree with you, sit down at the same table, like, you know, and just talk. And it kind of, it's baffling to me that in our church where we value equality, unity, where we value people at the core more, and we say that we value more than in the political sphere, we need to have more of these tables and just talk about real life and do that. I think that when you claim your identity and do not disrespect someone else's, I think that's that's a very good thing. And I think when it comes to what you were talking about, civil disobedience, is that instead of uncivility, it's the shaming versus rebuking kind of principle.
Absolutely.
No, that goes into that.
The last quick thing I'll say is just, you know, I think particularly in our church, I feel like we just have to understand, like, I just feel like the metrics of a lot of people have to change. And one of the things that bother me sometimes, and, you know, and it's not about which side of the issue that you're on. It's more about the analogies that I think sometimes are used. Like, oftentimes I've heard, like, for example, well, if you're an employee for a Fortune 500 company and they implement some kind of a policy, are you just going to violate that policy? So then why do you think you can do that in the church? Well, there's a couple problems with that. First of all, we're a church, we're not a business, and people shouldn't be looked at as commodities or employees that are just supposed to assent to whatever, you know, quote unquote, Big Brother says and decides for a company. But also, that analogy isn't true, because a lot of companies have what are called unions, which can advocate for change within that system. And so if enough employees think that a policy is unjust, they could go on strike, or they can decide that, you know, we're not going to show up and let's see how well the business runs then. So I think that people sometimes don't understand the implications of the analogies they use, because if we did want to run the church like a business, then on the flip side, you know, we have unions that could say, well, we're going to do what we think is best in our area of the world. So if you don't want that tit for tat, then don't describe the church as a business where people just have to be compliant and subordinate, because it doesn't even really work like that in the business world. Mm. You know, we're a church. We're supposed to be the body of Christ. We're supposed to be a beloved community. And biblical unity actually requires difference. You know, the hand cannot function the same way as the eye. You know, I mean, that would look crazy. You know, and so we can't expect people to come into this just sort of mandated uniformity in order to in any way effectuate mission, because that actually in lots of ways is going to hinder mission in some areas of the world, particularly the NAD, because people don't want to be a part of something like that. You know, so that's my big thing, man. It's just I would just hope that folks could develop more trust with one another to say, look, I don't understand why you believe what you believe over in your area of the world, but you're my brother or sister in Christ. We're both Adventists. We both believe in Christ and Him crucified, and we believe in His ability to save us. We believe in the gospel. We believe in the power of His Spirit, and we want His Spirit to be poured out on all flesh so that we can finish the work. You know, I believe that if we sat down at the table, we could get enough of those on a paper that we agree with to then say, all right, the things we disagree with aren't going to necessarily hinder us from doing this. So let's just move forward and do it. Let's be who we say we are. Let's be a church, you know? So that would be my final call on that.
Awesome. Cool. All right. Well, thanks a bunch. Thanks for everything. You. As you said, that was your final call, so I will not ask you for a final word unless you want to say something else.
No, that's it. Let's just be a church.
Awesome.
Let's be a church.
That was our topic on civility and unity with Michael Nixon. Thanks for listening. We hope that you're able to share this with another person that is interested in the topic. We hope that you enjoy this series on Law and Order. This marks the end, as I said in the introduction, so make sure to share it with others if there's any topic that you found very interesting. If you want to give us any feedback, please go to disruptiveadventism.org.
or go to our social media pages, leave a comment, send us a DM. We are on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, at Disruptive Adventism. So make sure to go there and to help us out. Also, subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcatching app. Please make sure to leave a review. That really helps us to get out there and get our content to be listened by many different people. So make sure to share it with others. Thanks for listening. If you want to collaborate financially to the podcast, every penny goes back into the podcast. So make sure that you go to patreon.com/disruptiveadventism. Thank you for listening today. We really hope that you join us next time. And as always, we invite you to be disruptive.